Coach Fraz here and
Coach Brick.
Just talking about some golf scenarios. Brick and I were kind of thinking about some things that seem common knowledge to seasoned golfers, but you know, sometimes it's good to review that stuff just to keep it fresh in your mind, especially when the season's coming up. And just a way to approach the game in the golf course. I think this is a good conversation to have. What do you think?
I would agree with that. You know, even whether you've been on the course thousands of times or a single digit number, it's always good to review, you know, multiple things. I've been a teacher for 16 years and I reviewed things today, this morning, that I probably learned as a first year teacher. So I think we can apply that to a lot of different scenarios, and that's what we're here to talk about.
Sure, and we're going to talk about some lingo today. And, you know, a lot of times terms get thrown around for people, and maybe you're a little unsure of it, but you don't want to ask in front of everybody, and you may be a little embarrassed. So we're just going to talk about some stuff, some things that should be common knowledge. If they aren't common knowledge, a good start talking points for you guys and girls. So if you have any questions like that after you listen today, let us know and we can clarify stuff for you. But we just want you to think about the game. And, you know, obviously, Coach and I, we love the game so much, and we just kind of want you to experience it the same way as well as compete at a high level. So I think we're going to start off about and kind of connect with the good shot journal and keeping our stats. We're going to talk about fairway and regulation and green and regulation and putts and what that means. So Coach, you want to talk about fairways and reg real quick?
Yeah, so when we're looking at fairways and regulation, we're looking at, you know, shots off of the tee that land in the fairway. So not right rough, not left rough, not, you know, first cut off the side. It's a shot that's landing in the fairway, which is obviously the ideal spot to continue, you know, your strokes with the hole. So, you know, when you're looking at how many fairways you hit, whether you nuked it or not, you know, kind of look at where the direction of the ball and where it finishes and where it lies after it stops and approach for your next shot.
Yep, and there's no fairway in regulation on a par three because obviously you don't want to hit it in the fairway on a par three because you want to hit it on the green, which takes us to green in regulation. And so green in regulation is a little bit more complex than a fairway in regulation, because fairway in regulation is just you're either in the fairway off the tee or you're not. But greens in regulation are slightly different. So there's three different types of holes on a golf course. There's a par three, a par four, and a par five. So a par three, in order to hit a green in regulation, you hit the green in one shot. So after your first shot, you're on the putting surface. And that has to be, it has to be on the surface, not on the fringe, not on the apron, but the ball has to be resting on the surface. And you can remove the pin to, you have to remove the pin to putt, or actually in the new rules, you don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. So par three on the green in one, and then par four, because they're a little longer, you're going to be on the green in two or less. So if you hit the green off your drive, like some monsters do, and you end up on the green in one and you're putting for an eagle, that would be a green in regulation because you hit the green in less than two strokes. So any other stroke, and this came up on the bus the other day, you know, I hit the green, but it was on my third shot, and because there was a penalty, but I hit the green from the fairway. A green in regulation has to be hit in two shots or less, including your penalty stroke. And then the last one's a par five, which we all know, everybody who is a monster on the golf course that nukes drives and hits bombs is gonna hit the green in three strokes or better. So whether you, I don't know, Coach, if anybody's ever hit the drive on a par five.
That'd be a good stat to look up. Stat man?
Stat, we're gonna do a little Denman on this one. So you're gonna hit the par five in three strokes or less. So
I believe isn't a on a par five, if you make a one, which I think has happened, I believe it's called a condor.
Ooh.
I believe.
Oh, I've never heard that.
Fact check that for sure, because I might have just made that up.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I've never heard that. Mm-hmm. But I do know knocking it in for a deuce on a par five is an albatross.
Yes.
Which,
yes.
Coach, I almost had an albatross 2 weeks ago.
You did?
Yeah, it was wild.
Where was this?
Old Homestead. I was 250 out.
Uh-huh.
lasered a par a 3-wood and it rolled just past the pin.
Sounds like a great shot.
It was phenomenal.
You saw from 250 yards away?
Yeah, it was right in front of me. It was it was going towards the pin, just veered off. It ended up finishing like 10 feet away. So obviously I made birdie instead of eagle.
Absolutely.
But, you know, that's what good long hitters do. They don't make eagles, they make birdies.
It's a good position.
So the fairways in reg, greens in reg is one of those. That's kind of why we're doing stats, because the higher your percentages of hitting fairways in reg and the higher your percentages of hitting greens in regulation are going to help you obviously make, you know, lower scores. If you recall, Chris LaRosa discussed how the handicap system works of people hitting greens in reg. And
it's a little flawed, I think.
It is flawed. There is a solution out there, because I do believe there's a solution to most problems in the world. So we're going to defer to Chris on this one. But so once you hit your green in regulation, here's where putts come into play. And in order for a putt to count near total, your ball must be on the green and you must putt it. So now, ball's on the green, you hit your first putt, you miss it, and then you tap in, and that's two putts. So here's where the kind of tricky parts come in, when the ball's not on the green. So, Coach, you want to talk about all the situations where the ball, you could potentially putt from not off the green or not on the green?
I believe what you're referring to, Coach, is if I have, you know, a ball that might be short of the green, that is in the fairway, is, you know, right on the fringe, which a ball that is lying on the fringe cannot be marked, picked up and marked.
Good point, Coach.
So that's a penalty. So, you know, in that situation where you see yourself in a position where you can, you'd rather putt than put yourself in a chipping situation, that you know, could be used there. One of my personal favorite things to do in that situation is also the bump and run skis.
Absolutely.
Different than a putt, but very effective. Yeah, very effective. You know, and there could be other scenarios, you know, where athletes are putting from off of the green. I've seen, you know, hybrid shots when you're on that collar where it's right up against the rough and the fringe, and you know, you're not sure if you're going to get that putter head through and make that clean contact, so you might pull out a hybrid, or I've heard even three metal at that point, but you might have to go to Josh for that.
Creative.
So
maybe that's where the tri-metal comes into play.
You know what? I honestly think that's why some people carry it in their bag.
Well, there are three metals because it's a tri-metal, and that's optimal for those little bump and run skis from the apron.
And while we're talking about putting, you know, I think, you know, one thing that I've seen now after, you know, a week or so into the season, you know, we have players that, you know, might have a long distance putt and you lag that baby and it's right up next to the hole and, you know, you're less than a foot away. And I've seen players miss those short putts. And I don't know if it's more of, you know, not taking the time to line it up because you are so close, you know, 9 times out of 10, that ball is dropping. However, I still think it's important to go through some of your, you know, putting routine and make sure that you have that right line before you knock that baby in.
Yeah. I used to, in college at Westchester, I used to mark everything unless it was a tap in or a foot or closer. And Coach, I'll talk about one of the easiest ways to lose some confidence is when you miss a 3-footer because you rushed it. So definitely, that was a great point, Coach. Mark that ball, line it up, go through your routine and knock that thing in. Don't take those for granted, especially at, you know, an establishment like Pinecrest. You know those greens can get twisty. So mark that thing.
And another thing with putting, while we're talking about it, is the idea of the flag stick. You know, if you are somebody that prefers that flag stick being yanked out and the other three playing partners are leaving it in, that's certainly something that you can have happen. You know, it's not because everybody else is leaving it in that you have to as well. If it's a type of putt where you'd like that flag stick yanked out so you don't hit that middle, that dead center putt in the heart, you know, and hits that flag stick and bounces out. You know, a couple different scenarios there, but just be mindful of you having that right. You have that privilege to have that flag stick yanked.
And you could yank that thing from anywhere. You could be on the green, you can be off the green. I've seen people, and done it myself, pull it out when you're chipping because you're concerned that with the pace of the ball coming to the hole. I don't know, we're going to have to check with Statman on the miles per hour on a chip that was going to hit the flag and then bounce out. But that's a really good point. That thing can be pulled from anywhere. I mean, you can pull that from 100 if you're feeling confident.
You sure can.
So
stuffing it.
You stuff that thing, and that brings us into a great point where we're talking a little bit about sand saves and how do we count that as a statistic. So there's bunkers all over the golf course. There's greenside bunkers and fairway bunkers, and a sand save is considered when you're in the sand and you hit your shot and you end up making par or better in order to make a sand save. So you have to make par or better. If you're in the sand and you hit it out of the sand and then you make the putt and that's a bogey, that's not considered a sand save, even though you hit it out of the sand once and only putted once. You have to make par or better for a sand save, which kind of brings us into talking about penalties. And there's two types of penalty areas, or there's two types of penalties you can incur on the golf course, or two types of areas that you can work from. So there's white stake areas, and then there's red and yellow stake areas. And those red and yellow stake areas are actually called penalty areas, Coach, because they used to be called lateral and water hazards, but the USGA grouped them into a penalty area to kind of keep the language the same. So, Coach, you want to talk about the procedure a little bit about, well, we did talk about white stakes already. So you want to talk a little bit about the penalty area procedure?
Yeah, so the penalty area procedure, like Coach talked about with the red and yellow stakes, when you're hitting, or excuse me, if your ball goes into those areas, obviously you're going to go in and take a look and see if you can find your ball first, unless it's in the water.
How long do you get, Coach?
I want to say it is exactly 180 seconds.
You are exactly right.
Yeah, 180 seconds, which is equivalent to 3 minutes. 2 years advanced math.
And when does that start?
I believe that starts when you get to the spot where that ball is going into that penalty area.
It sure does. Yeah. You know, you're not only smart in math, you are smart in English as well.
But yeah, so if I'm going to the penalty area, I'm checking for that ball first, because a ball can be played out of that penalty area.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's something where I'm not, you know, able to find it, I'm taking two club lengths
from the point it entered.
From the point it entered, no closer to the hole. Typically going to use the big stick there. You know, that's why you have the driver in the bag as well.
Big, good time to pull out the big dog.
Because that's, you know, you get the most length for your drop in that
45
scenario.
Inches, yeah. Potentially 45 and a half. If you got one like that.
Yeah. And you are dropping within that area, two club lengths from that penalty mark. You know, dropping from your knee, you know, giving yourself a spot. If it rolls into that penalty area, what are we doing then, Coach?
So if it rolls, the only time you would redrop is if it rolls closer to the hole, or you would redrop when the ball hits the ground and rolls outside of the two club lengths of that drop area.
Yeah.
So then you would do two drops, and you would actually place, you would drop it a third time, and then you would place on the spot that the ball lands after the third drop.
So not very often that we'd run into that scenario. But,
you know, thinking about how that would be in Pinecrest, I'm thinking par fives, three, four, that water that's on the left there, if you got a little close, like if there was a sprinkler head over there and you were taking a free drop, and you know, your one club length from your nearest point of relief there, and potentially it starts to roll down into the water and, you know, it rolls out of the drop area, that might be where you would need to place, or on a steep hill or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your procedure for penalty areas. So that's just a stroke penalty. It's not stroke and distance. Stroke and distance comes into play when you have white stakes. And white stakes are considered out of bounds. So they're different than the red or yellow. And the white stakes, you have to replay from the original spot you played from. So if you hit it off the tee, you have to hit another one off the tee. And if you've heard people say stroke and distance, the penalty there is it's a one-stroke penalty, and you have to take the distance, meaning the distance that you played from. So the penalty area is just a stroke penalty, not stroke and distance in that particular area. No. So that would be your penalty area. But I also want to talk a little bit about provisional balls. And Coach, you want to explain when to hit a provisional ball, when not to hit a provisional ball?
Yeah, so provisional ball, you know, if we, you know, Pinecrest being our home track, you know, home of the North Penn Knights, we got a lot of white stakes around many of the holes on that front nine. And I think we're at a point where we have enough comfort with the course, and we know where those white stakes are. And you have an idea of your shot shape and what might look like it's flirting with that white stake. And if you are somebody that is flirting with that white stake, or you know that it's definitely out of bounds, you know, you're going to hit your shot, you know, or if it's a ball that could be there, but you're not positive. I mean, what's worse than driving up, seeing your ball out of bounds, and having to drive back to the tee to re-tee?
Or walk, in the case of a high school player.
Yeah,
if actually, there's a coach not present.
I didn't think of that. Yeah, that's a lot of steps. So, you know, in that situation, if you think that it's anywhere near, it's close, you're not positive because you just hit it 285 yards and it's going around a tree. You know there's some houses over there. You know, hit that second ball. Announce that it's provisional before you tee that baby up and smack it. You know, that's just, you know, best practice there. And if you find it, you know, you're picking that provisional up and you're playing that first ball as long as it's in play.
And you know what, coach, this provisional ball rule is really an awesome thing, especially when you're on the first hole and you kind of, you're not loose. This gives you an opportunity to get another free swing potentially if your ball's close to being out of bounds. Even if you know your ball is in, but your ball is close to being out of bounds, go ahead and say, I'm just going to hit another provisional. I'm going to hit a provisional right here. And it's a free swing to kind of get yourself acclimated, even if you know that it's still in that particular case. Coach, when do you not hit a provisional ball?
When that ball is going into a penalty area?
Yep. Yeah, so if you're not sure, so let's say, for example, you definitely want to hit one when it goes into white stakes. Mm-hmm. Now, if you see the ball going into red stakes, and you play a provisional ball, that provisional ball is now in play, even if you find the ball in the red stake or yellow staked areas.
I feel like that this probably has happened to some of the members on the team, maybe opponents. Like that's an interesting little twist on it, because you don't want to be playing a ball, a second ball, when you know you have another ball that you need to drop in that penalty area.
And coach, and believe it or not, This is not only for you, but this is also if your playing opponent does something like this. This is a good moment that you may have to invoke the rules that say, oh, if your playing partner says, oh, I'm going to play a provisional here after they hit it into a red staked area, and you just want to potentially warn them and say, hey, if you play this provisional, it's in play, even if we find your first one. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal, because you're really taking a stroke and distance penalty in a penalty area rather than just the stroke area. So when you're counting these penalty strokes, I'd like to do something simple, because I'm a man that tries to simplify things.
I like the way you do this, by the way.
So the easiest way to count penalty strokes, because a lot of people say, oh, I hit one in, two out, three, and it gets kind of confusing. So when you're counting penalty strokes, the easiest way to do this is count up the number of times you hit the ball. So let's say you hit the ball four times and you had one penalty. So you would say, I hit the ball four and I had one penalty, so I'm going to add one stroke, and then that gives me a five. And I find that to be the easiest way to do that. Now, if you had two penalties and you hit the ball four times, you would say four strokes, and then you had two penalty strokes, so four plus two is six for counting your penalties. And believe it or not, coach, one of my legendary moments ever, I had five penalties.
Ooh.
On one hole.
Ooh. What'd you make on that hole?
17.
Ooh, that's the 17?
Yeah, five penalty strokes.
The Alshon Jeffrey, can we call that?
We call it the Alshon Jeffrey, sure. I made that before he was in the league, so retroactive, we could look back, we could definitely call that the Alshon Jeffrey. So just a couple of other things to think about when you're on the golf course, especially at Pinecrest or anywhere we're playing here for the Suburban One, or anywhere you're playing in general, replacing divots and repairing ball marks. Coach, when is it important to replace a divot, and when is it important to fill it with some seed, if you don't have a divot? If you don't have seed or anything like that, let's walk through that a little bit.
Well, I'll just say, you know, as players walk in the course, you don't have seed, you know, nearby. You may have, a coach in a cart that can help you out in that scenario. But I would definitely say we're fixing ball marks, you know, 100% of the time. It's always worth a look where you have an idea, where your ball landed, you know, get your little tool out, fix that mark. And
how do you fix that thing?
You know what?
It's tricky.
It can be tricky, and I think there's some that have been misguided.
Yes.
Which is unfortunate.
Kind of like the Washington football team not creating a...
They should do more. Yes. That's embarrassment.
Total.
With that being said, the ball marks, you know, we're looking for our ball marks. We're also looking for other ball marks, too.
Great
There
point.
Could be some others around the area. You know, let's put this, you know, this course in a better place than when you got it. You know, I think that's always a good general rule of thumb. The same thing goes for divots. You know, you get a big old beaver tail after, you know, you got a little deep on it, a little thick.
You
try to put some more spin on it, and you got some turf, you know. If you have a large divot, best practice, go...
Long and deep.
Long and deep, yeah. Go grab that piece of turf that you just took out of the course. Mm. Go grab it, put it back, you know, in the way, you know, it's always kind of like a geometry, you know, like shapes and things like that. You want to get that shape right. You don't want to do it wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and put it sideways or
wrong. Like put the wrong, like you flip it. I've seen that happen so many times.
Because sometimes a divot can look the same on both sides. Similar.
It's like pounding a peg into a square hole or a square peg into a round hole.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great point.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah, so go grab that turf, put it back, you know, stomp it down. You know, if it's a situation where you do have seed available, once again, you know, when you're old enough to drive a cart, they're carrying seed. So go throw some down, stomp it. It'll really help out, you know, really take good care of the course as you're playing.
You know, and there is some seed. There's going to be most likely most of the golf courses we play or that you're going to end up playing, there will be seed on par threes on the tees. Mm-hmm. On the tee of a par three, it's a good rule of thumb to use seed to repair your savage moment on the tee. And if you have if there's a divot on the tee, you're not going to replace a divot on the tee. You're going to use the seed instead because it's a different type of grass.
Sure. One thing I like to go to while we're talking about the greens is and we talked about pins beforehand, but pin locations, I think is, you know, something that needs to be brought up because, you know, many times we go to a course, you know, today we're at Indian Valley, but when we're typically at Pinecrest, you know, we have different colored flag sticks.
Yes.
It's not always the case, but many times it is. Where your red flag represents the front of the green, that's a pin that's located in the front, the white is located in the middle, and a blue represents a back pin placement.
Coach, what would happen if there's not flag, it's the same flag color? Is there any other way to indicate front, back, middle? Can you think of?
Yes, the smaller flag that is also on the flag stick.
Is that just for decoration?
That's not decoration, in fact. That is also able to help you out with front, middle, and back pin placement.
You know what? I always thought that was just for fun. Like, oh, you know, let's try and trick the golfers. I will put a big flag and a little flag. And, you know, maybe some people got tricked by that.
Yeah. What I'm getting to here is, you know, if we have a front pin placement and we're zooming in at 135 yards on that range finder, you know, so... If we're going to hit a shot and we're in between two clubs here, are we going to hit a shot that our max distance and carry is, let's call it a buck 30, a buck 27, or we're going to take a club up there and make sure that we're confidently on that green with, you know, that buck 40 club and maybe taking a little off it, but also getting that full carry so that you are putting. You're on that flat surface given that putt.
Yeah, the percentages of making a par when you're on the green are much higher than chipping up. So taking a little bit more when the pin's in the front is definitely a good thing because you want to be on that surface. And same thing, when there's a back pin and you're staring that thing down and you got all the green in the world in front of you, and let's take a 153 number to the back pin. Mm-hmm. So when you got that 153 number to the back pin, you know, you want to hit something that your max number is probably like 150. You know, I don't know if you can, I know Coach has got 153 in the bag easily, but I just, you know, maybe you take that 150 club and kind of jump on it a little bit, so try and get the extra three, but you know the max distance that you're going to hit that thing is 150 yards, because long is most likely going to be dead.
So I shouldn't take out my 160 club in that situation.
Right. So you're not trying to take a little off of your 160 club. And again, this is without wind, without uphill, downhill. But what you're thinking about in these situations where the pin is in the front or the back or the middle is, where do I have the best chance of hitting the ball on the green with the club that I have in my hand? So a 150 shot, you know, you may not get it all the way back to the pin, but you know it's not going to go past the pin into the death trap.
Out of bounds.
Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes there's like a bunker or water back there, or in Lampetock's case, like a tree that's going to grab your ball and hold it tight. So you never know. So it's good to think about that when you have a front pin, back pin, middle pin. You know, middle pin, you're trying to zero in a little bit more. It's okay to take more or less in a middle pin because you're probably going to get it on or not get it on. So that, I think that's a good time to kind of talk about uphill shots, downhill shots, side hill.
We are going to Letter Rock on Tuesday, which is undulation.
Total undulation, a lot. And for those of you that don't know what undulation means, it just means not flat. And Letter Rock is the mecca of disc flatness.
In Montgomery County, yeah.
Yeah, of course. So, in the public realm, obviously.
Yes.
So, when we're talking about uphill shots or downhill shots, or you say, oh, man, that's uphill. I need to take a little more. I think that's going to be something. I'll talk about uphill, Coach, and then you talk about downhill. So, when you talk about an uphill shot, that means that the area where you're hitting the ball to is higher than where you're standing at that particular moment with the ball. So like a good example would be number 9 at Pinecrest from the fairway to the green. That's an uphill shot because the green level is higher than where you're going to be in the fairway. So in that particular case, you're going to want to add 5 to 10 yards onto the club that you're playing. So for example, if the yardage is 150, then you need to take that?
No.
If your average is 150, or your yardage is 150, and you're playing an uphill shot, you might want to hit a 160 club to take into account, because what ends up happening is the ball does not go, it goes shorter when you're going uphill because it has less time to be in the air. So a 160 will kind of account for the difference of height. And now some rangefinders, not legal in our league, have a slope gradient that will tell you the adjusted yardage, which is what we're talking about with an uphill shot playing 10 yards longer, but those are not legal in the league. So that's something that you're going to want to calculate on your own. So Coach, what do you do on a downhill shot? If you're an uphill shot, you got to add.
Yeah, so downhill shot, the hole that comes to mind is number 3 at Pinecrest, because a lot of that par five. You know, you got that par 5, and if you get it good, you might be looking at a second shot into that green, which would be a downhill shot for sure. From that spot that you're hitting that second shot, and it can be the third shot as well. You have a green that is below where your ball is placed at that point. And you know, if you think about Pinecrest, behind that green is no good.
So that's certainly a dead trap.
Want to take away, subtract for lack of a better words, you know, some distance of the club that you're pulling out of the bag to hit that shot. You know, once again, this is in the case where we don't have wind as a factor, you know, wind speed, wind direction. We're talking about, you know, a nice calm day and you're hitting a shot. So you're taking a little bit off that club that might go, you know, a buck 20, or, you know, you're clubbing down in that situation to secure that position on the green for that putt for birdie.
So Coach, why do you take less club, meaning shorter distance on a downhill shot? Why do you think that is?
Well, Coach, I think the best way to explain that is...
Scientifically, of course.
Scientifically, yes. So the trajectory of the ball is, you know, when you hit a ball, it goes up in the air, right? So as that ball travels...
Like a parabolic movement.
Yes, a parabolic movement. It's going to go up in the air. It gets to a point. It's apex. That's the highest point.
Yep.
Of that ball flight, and it's going to start coming down. But as it comes down, it doesn't drop straight down.
Nope.
It's not a 50-pound, you know, weight. It's a golf ball. So it's going to continue to travel forward as it drops. And as it travels forward, that's going to give it more distance. So that ball will continue to fall As the green's being lower, the ball falls further and you get a little more distance out of it.
So you're telling me because the ball's in the air longer, it travels further?
Correct.
That makes a lot of sense on an uphill shot or a downhill shot. And then let's talk a little bit about sidehill shots. Coach, do you like a shot where your feet are above the ball, or do you like a shot where your feet are below the ball? And let's talk about what's your favorite, and then I'll take the other one.
I'll be honest, I am a big fan of feet being below the ball. I don't mind a little choke up on the club. So if I'm hitting a shot and my feet are below the ball, I'm choking up a little bit on that club. You know, sometimes I'm
What do you mean by choke up?
Choking up, so, you know, like I think baseball terms.
Yeah,
you know, where I'm choking up on a bat, where your hands are moving up. In this case, we're talking about a golf club, we're moving down the grip, all right? There's times where you might not even have your hands on the grip because you have that much of your feet below the ball.
Like your thumb is on the shaft?
Yes,
like
correct.
Like off the grip?
Correct.
You've had that kind of shot?
I've had that shot, yeah. It was a great shot, too.
Well, I know you mastered that shot, obviously.
Yeah.
But what happens to the ball when you play, when you hit a shot and the ball is above your feet, what happens to that thing?
Many times, so if I'm a righty, so let's say that my feet are below the ball, my shot, the ball is going to pull more to the left side as I'm hitting that that side hill shot. So
naturally, the ball is going to go from right to left when the ball is above your feet, right?
Correct. Ball above the feet, going right to left. Correct.
So when the ball is below your feet, it's going to travel slightly different, right?
Correct. It seems like it would.
So when the ball's below your feet, it's going to travel in the opposite direction. It's going to actually go away from the hill, and it's going to go left to right in kind of a slice format for a right-handed golfer, or even a hook for a lefty, which we don't have any lefties on our team this year. But so the ball will travel left to right, and it kind of, and that's just because the way your club comes through is typically going to, it kind of glances the ball.
And I don't know about you, Coach, but a lot of times I think with my hand adjustment, like choking up on that club, I think a lot of times I compensate for that, and I might not get as much pull left or right. So I'm not sure about a drastic right to left or a drastic left to right, but something. There's movement there.
Right. So you're saying when you're preparing for your shot and when you're visioning how that ball flies, when you got the ball above your feet, you're going to aim more to the right because you know it's going to curve to the left. And then when the ball's below your feet, you know you're going to aim a little bit more to the left because the ball's going to travel to the right. And that's a good way to think about these side hill shots whenever you're out there. And then when you got to go, you know, those are side hill, uphill, downhill, but sometimes whenever you're playing, you know, this world we live in is not a still world. It's not static.
No, we move.
Yeah, it moves and the air moves. And when the air moves, they call that wind. So sometimes whenever you're playing with the wind, you can ride the wind, or sometimes you gotta cut through the wind and hit a punch shot. Coach, what's your favorite club to punch? And walk me through your thought process.
My favorite club to punch would be my 5-iron. And with my 5-iron shot, whether, you know, punching through that wind or punching, I want a lot of distance, but I got to stay below this tree line, this branch. Happens every once in a while, being on, you know, right side, left side. You know, I'm going to make sure that ball is a little forward in my stance, and I'm not maybe going to take my full swing, my full hack at it. You know, I'm focusing on getting clean contact, but I'm not really concerned of that ball really lofting up in the air.
Right. Yeah, and one of the things that I think happens on a punch shot is people, you can abbreviate your swing and take it back a 3/4 swing, and you're kind of coming down on the ball, and you're kind of, instead of finishing high with your hands, you're kind of finishing your hands around, and like, you know, what you're trying to do is keep the ball underneath the wind. And when you're doing that, what you're doing is you're trying to eliminate the trajectory and hit it lower, keep it under the wind. But one of the biggest mistakes that I've seen people when they're hitting punch shots is not being aggressive through the hitting area. And that's the kiss of death in a punch, is doing a punch shot and kind of slowing up because you feel like you don't have to hit it as hard, but your body naturally does it. So one of the things that I always think about on a punch shot is to be aggressive and attack.
Get after it.
Get after it, because even, you have to get after the ball in order for that thing to travel.
What's your favorite punch shot?
club, Coach?
Well, Coach, that's a really good question, because I like to punch the ball all around the golf course. And one of my favorite things to punch, I love to punch a pitching wedge.
Mm.
And I like to saw that thing off. But one of my favorite punch shots in the trees, I love like a 4-iron that gets, you know, 6 to 4.5 feet off the ground.
A little stingy.
Yeah, a little sting guy. It's one of my favorite shots to hit, and it's gotten me out of a lot of trouble in my life on the golf course.
Saving strokes. One day at a time.
Well, I mean, you know, you can't make every putt and go nuts, but this is one of those moments that is just as good as the celebration. So let's talk a little bit about, since we're talking about changing the trajectory of how the balls hit high, low, and all that stuff, let's talk about chips and bumps and your favorite, the old Runskinator. So when we're talking about chip shots and we're talking about bump shots, one of the things that I've kind of learned to appreciate is your hand position when you're hitting a chip shot around the green or a bump shot. And the one thing that I always think that the amateur players always overlook is having their hands pressed a little bit forward of the ball. And what happens is, if your hands are even with the ball, especially at impact, you're going to either scull the shot, meaning hit the ball with the bottom of the club, or you're going to hit a fat shot and lay a little sod over top. Mm. And we all know about those shots. Mm. So one of the keys when you're hitting a chip, a bump, and the old Runskinator is make sure you get your hands inside your left groin. And that's one of those things that really helps on chips. And ball position is definitely important with that. But I also, so the two areas that I see the most struggle is the hands aren't far enough forward. And we're watching a kid right now. Look at how his hands are right over top.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he just putted that. Maybe that's why his hands were over top. But that, you know, and you want to press your hands a little forward on a putt too. But anyway, so your hands aren't far enough on a chip. But also another thing that I see, another area is players not being aggressive through chips. Even though it's a short shot, you still have to make an aggressive pass to the ball, because it won't get caught on the grass as much, and you still want to have aggressive play at it, even though it's a chip or a run. So a chip shot, you're starting with your hands just inside your left groin if you're a righty. If you're a lefty, which we don't have any, your hands would be inside your right groin. And basically you're going like hands would be hip to hip, and the ball's going to be a little bit back of the middle of your stance, and that ball should come out, fly up, and land. Like, Coach, what do you like better, pancakes or waffles?
I gotta pick one.
Yeah, when you're chipping.
Oh, I'm sorry. What do I like better, pancakes or waffles?
Well, that's the first question, obviously.
Yeah, well, I definitely like waffles with some ice cream on top of
obviously.
It.
Obviously. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Okay, so
when we're chipping, we want it to land like a pancake.
Yeah.
So it'll land and kind of land and roll out. So we're picking a spot to land it. We're trying to land it on that spot. Kind of like that drill, that game that we played on the putting green, where you try to land near the tee and you wanted to land short or long of it. And that was a good way of thinking about chip shots. So, Coach, you want to talk about the old bump and run ski, and I'll talk about flop shots?
Sure. Yeah, and the bump and run, I was mentioning it earlier. Mm. I really think it's you know, not a specific club that you might be selecting. I think each player is a little different about what type of club they would use in that scenario. I'll be honest, I use two clubs when I'm doing the old bump and run skis.
Ooh.
And it really does depend on the scenario. Mm. I like to go to my 9-iron, and I like to go to my pitching wedge.
All right, Coach, you were, we were so rudely interrupted, but I do want to think, let's go back and let's talk about the bold bump and Runskinator, and you were talking about 9-iron bumps, pitching wedge bumps, and how that whole thing worked out.
Yeah, so in that situation when I'm gonna hit that bump and run shot, I do want some green to work with. So I want a shot that's going to land and travel. So if it's a shot where, you know, it's a middle pin placement, and I just want to, you know, I might choose more of a, you know, standard, typical chip shot that doesn't have that extra lag, that extra roll to get up to the hole. So I'll take out my 9 iron, I'll take out my pitching wedge. And it does really kind of depend on the loft and the hole location. But I'll notice it can be pretty effective when used properly. I will not hit a bump and run shot if it's a poor lie. If it's a poor lie, I'm not getting the loft on the ball, and there's a good chance that that's not going to end up at, a good spot on the green or on the green at all. So that's when I will use that shot to try to put it up. And the stroke that I'm going to use on that bump and run is very similar to a putt. That club, because it has less loft than your wedges, your standard sand wedge and lob wedge, that club is going to get a lower trajectory. Which then is also going to get some extra roll out of it. So a putting stroke is really all you need for that ball to move.
So it doesn't land as far as a chip or a flop, and it rolls the remainder of the way. It lands about a quarter of the distance and then rolls out three quarters of the distance.
I think that's a great fraction. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you use the 9 in the pitching wedge. I use 2 clubs to bump. I actually bump a 6 and an 8.
Wow.
Yeah. So, sometimes whenever you need a really long one and the reason I do 6 and 8 is because I like to try and keep that stroke very similar to my putter. So if I feel like I have to take my stroke is longer than what I would usually use for a putt, I take more club and it actually lands like an eighth of the way and then rolls seven-eighths of the way.
That's a great fraction also, and it makes sense with the different loft of that club.
So there's some creativity when you're playing around the green and you're using the trusted, ever reliable bump and run. You could use a 6-iron, you could use an 8, you could use a 9, you could use a pitch. There's any way you could play a bump and run, but the nuts and bolts of this shot is it lands about a quarter of the way and rolls the other three quarters.
And is it a good spot to mess around with this during a match as far as what that club for a bump and run is for?
Nah.
What you use it for?
This would be a moment whenever we're at mainland or we're doing short game practice, and this would be a good time to kind of calibrate how far you want to hit that thing. And I like to typically, when I use a bump and run shot, there's nothing between me and the pin except for grass. So you're not using a bump and run shot over a sand trap or anything like that. So which brings us to our next shot, which would be known as the flop.
The flop. Let's hear about the flop.
So the flop is one of these shots where this is the only time in your I won't say the only time, because sometimes you got to get creative on the golf course.
For sure.
But this is one of the times where you're purposely opening the face, meaning the face is no longer square. The toe of the club is actually pointed a little bit more to the right, and the club lays a little bit flatter. And what that does is that actually adds loft to the wedge. Mm. And when you're swinging it, the ball actually travels higher and lands a lot softer. So in this particular case, which is a lot different than the old bump and run skinator, you're going to be flying that thing maybe 4/5 of the way, and then it rolls out that extra 1/5 because it's got a lot of loft, kind of like when we were talking about the ball goes up in that parabolic movement and it hits the apex and starts to fall straighter to the ground because it was launched straight up.
And I think I was using the wrong terminology. We're talking about fractions, but this is really ratios.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. You're exactly right.
Yeah. Ratios for the ball in the air versus ball running out with all these shots.
That's a great way to say it. Now, there is an advanced shot that you can play to the flop shot. Now, all these shots that we're talking about, you're always going to start with your hands inside your left groin. There is an advanced shot, which is one that, when you start to hit the flop shot and you start to perfect that and master that, kind of like the master himself, Phil Mickelson.
Yes. 64-degree wedge.
You can get a 64-degree wedge and you can play a shot, or you can play your 56 or your 58 or your 60, but you could play a shot known as a parachute lob.
Ooh.
And a parachute lob is similar to a flop shot. The only difference between a parachute lob is your hands are not inside your left groin. You kind of move your hands back to the center, and even if you can get them back to your right groin, if you're a right-handed player, and that adds even more loft to the club, that you could just slip that thing right underneath And when you do that, the paw will go straight up in the air.
That sounds like it would take practice.
There's a lot of practice that comes with a parachute lob. And obviously, Mr. Coach Brick and I will demonstrate on command at any moment at Pinecrest at any time.
Fast.
But that's one of those shots that when you become a master short game artist like us, then we will be able to show that off to you. Now, just kind of looking through the list here a little bit, Coach, I think we talked a lot about everything that was on here.
I think the last couple of things, you know, and this was more just when we're talking about etiquette, you know, the pace of the play, it's challenging because we know you're out there, you have to hold everything out, you know, you're following the rule book. Sometimes you get, you know, caught up with opponents that might be slower players, you know, but I think it's always, you know, a good thing when you're pushing as much as you can. You know, you're making sure that you're ready with your wedge and your putter when you get to that green side, and that your bag is in a position where you're walking to the next hole, you can just scoop it up and move. So, you know, that pace of play is something that can be, sometimes it's out of your control if it's others, but, you know, I think it's good for the North Penn Knights to set a good example and make sure we're playing golf quickly, because a lot of times we are playing at public courses, and the public, they want to play golf and enjoy this game as well.
Yes, and other ways you can take one practice swing and get up and hit that thing. Multiple practice swings is unnecessary. I mean, when you're around the green and you're chipping, you know, it's okay to take a couple extra swipes at it, but it's important that you're taking one practice swing on the tee, one practice swing from the fairway, and hit that thing as fast as possible. Not as fast as possible, but within reason. So other ways, you know, when you're walking ahead, now this is one's important because this one has a lot to do with safety. When you're walking ahead, you're always looking over your shoulder to make sure that you're not in front of the person hitting, you're not distracting the person hitting. And when you get, so that's gonna help kind of continually push pace of play faster. But the other thing, when you get to your ball, if the other person's hitting, that's a good time to get your yardage, start planning the shot that you hit. Because once that person hits, it's your turn, and you don't want to waste time getting yardages. Obviously, if your ball's right in front of the other person, don't go stand in it while they're about to hit, because you're probably going to get hit in the back of the head. And that's just something, that's just safety and common sense. But if your ball, if their ball's on the left side and your ball's up there on the right side, 30 yards up, go ahead and walk over there, get your yardage. So once they clip that thing, you're ready to perform and hit that thing next to the cup.
I think the last point that I would like to make revolves around the need to pay attention to your opponent's score. This is actually breaking news, there are people that try to cheat on the golf course. And it's important that we are, you know, getting scores that are reported accurately. Unlike other sports, we don't have officials out there that are right there, you know, penalizing, you know, holding up a red card or yellow card for some type of foul, you know, or technical foul, or, you know, things of that nature. So it really is on the players to make sure that everything is being, you know, followed, that guidelines and rules that are established are being enforced on the course. So pay attention to your opponent's score. Do not take their word at the end of the hole that they made par, made bogey. You know, really think back of what your shots are. Think back of your opponent's shots as well. Confirm after each hole so there's no discrepancy, you know, after nine. You walk in and you're just able to give the coaches your card after you've checked and verified, and we're good to go.
Coach, when you say confirm after a hole, what do you mean by that?
So if I'm confirming after a hole, I'm playing against an opponent, just, you know, 1v1, and I'm confirming, hey Dom, you made four, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And then would you...
So if I wasn't confirming, what would I say?
If you weren't...
If I wasn't confirming, let's say you and I were playing together, mm-hmm. and I said, Legend Brick, what did you have there?
Ooh, yeah, so that leaves it up for the open. And obviously, I made birdie, which I didn't because I hit one in the water. So in that scenario, I got to think back, no, Legend Brick did not make birdie there.
As me, I got it. And then that's the moment where I would say, hey, Legend, birdie is out of the question because you knocked one in the juice right there.
Yeah.
So it's important when you're confirming that you as the scorer are saying the score to the person you're playing and not asking what they had, because that's the perfect opportunity for a weasel to try and pull off, oh, I just had a five there when they had an eight.
or something like that. So paying attention to other players on the golf course, and their, especially your opponents, you should be able to, at the end of the hole, count. You should be able to count your strokes and the play, your opponent's strokes. And not saying that everybody's a cheater or anything like that, but when your integrity is tested, you know, even the strongest willed can lose it. And I'll never forget, I had an accounting teacher in high school. Her name was William H. Bonnie Miller.
Ooh.
And she said, yeah, I mean, she was classic. She was borderline legend. And one thing she always said to me that stuck with me, and I hate accounting, but this stuck with me. And she said, integrity is the one thing you can never get back when you lose it.
Ooh. That's deep.
It is deep. I don't know if William H. Bonnie Miller's alive anymore, but I'll tell you, that stuck with me because, and what do I mean by that? You know, in this particular case, what are we talking about? You know, when somebody asks you your score, this is when your integrity comes in. You know, maybe somebody didn't see that stroke, or maybe somebody didn't see you hit it in the water and you quick dropped it, and then you could kind of pull a fast one. That's what we're talking about with the integrity. Making a four right there, yeah, of course it's going to help the team, but if you're throwing, if you're giving your integrity away and you're cheating, you're never going to get that back because you'll always be known as a cheater on the golf course. So I think, what do you think, Coach? Are we going to wrap up today?
I think we're going to wrap up. And it's just been a pleasure chatting with you today and sure talking has. All things golf.
All things golf here in our podcast on Coach's Corner, North Penn Golf. We stuffed it today. We made putts and we went nuts. And we talked all things golf, and there's going to be another scenario. There's going to be scenarios that we haven't touched upon, so we'll take comments from you in the chat or just in general, and we'll get together, and I think, Coach, we'll have another time where we get to talk all things golf again.
I would enjoy that.
Absolutely. All right, we'll catch you next time.
Go Knights.